Chapter 11, Race and Society. I had become convinced. Science spoke eloquently and pervasively. Race is real. It is flesh and blood, brain and hormones. It is in every cell, in our DNA, and in every particle of our being. It creates poverty or wealth, crime or community, superstition or science, ignorance or education, tyranny or freedom. It composes the melodies of Mozart or the obscenities of a rap song. It creates glittering cities of promise or disease-ridden slums. It slashes and burns the Amazon or plants a million trees. It gives birth to Aphrodites or crack babies. It carries mankind to the moon or casts him into hell. It not only colors our skin, it colors the world. It expresses itself in millions of ways, overt and subtle, hateful and sublime, raw and refined. And it rules us whether or not we want to acknowledge its power. It is like the tide. It will have its way. No matter how government might try with social welfare programs, education, or affirmative action, races cannot be legislated away or made equal to one another. No matter how the media tries to deny its power or even its existence, race asserts itself in the endemic social problems in the non-white races among us, in the technological miracles of our own people, and in the canyons of cultural differences between us. Only when we understand and recognize the power of race can we solve the problems that it creates, as well as reap its magnificent possibilities. My understanding about race developed by extensive reading in psychology, biology, history, and anthropology had all come together, with each supplementing the other and reinforcing the racial idea. Not only was I convinced of the underlying reality of race, I found inspiration, for I now believe that racial understanding holds the key to progress in civilization and even the evolutionary advancement of mankind itself. I also understood that ignoring its reality could have disastrous consequences for society. In the 1960s, America earnestly embarked on a program of social and political equality for the black race. What would be the outcome? Carlton Putnam and others applied the historical record and the evolutionary realities to America's new social policies. Because I knew that those social changes were based on the false dogma of racial equality, I came to believe that those policies were destined to fail. Egalitarianism was little more than a modern superstition imposed by the media political establishment. Its tenets were extremely vulnerable to rigorous challenge and debate. But I wondered, where is the debate? Advocates of egalitarianism held the seats of power in academia and in politics and in the popular media. Although many in the academic community knew its scientific absurdity, few dared to speak up forthrightly. Thankfully, many continued their research, but seduced by the rhythm of the times, they avoided its racial implications as much as they could. As more psychologists rediscovered the powerful role of heredity in intelligence and behavior, most talked about it in terms of how genetics affected the individual, while they very carefully avoided the racial issue, even though their work confirmed the facts of inherent racial differences. If one sees heredity as a primary determinant of mental ability and personality, then the dramatically lower black IQ scores and rampant black social dysfunction can only be plausibly explained by genetically determined racial differences. not by environmental determination. The acknowledgement of heredity's powerful role in group behavior and norms struck at the foundations of the myth of racial equality, and the racial egalitarians fought back with a viciousness bordering on religious hysteria. Some of the few academicians who dared to discuss race were, even in the most moderate fashion, such as Professor Arthur Jensen, were met with academic intolerance and physical intimidation. Scientific pioneers such as Nobel Prize winner William Shockley were physically restrained from scheduled speeches at some of America's most prestigious universities. Dr. Edward O. Wilson, premier sociobiologist at Harvard University, who tactfully avoided the race issue as much as he could, found himself victimized by both character assassination and violent assault. And as a side note for this audio tape, the great professor, Dr. Watson, who basically discovered the double helix of the DNA, an incredible discovery, probably the greatest scientist of our era, actually lost his job because he dared to talk about some racial truths which certainly can't be denied or refuted. In spite of desperate resistance, the essential tenets of sociobiologists, behavioral geneticists, and hereditarians eventually triumphed in the scientific community. Although few of them, even today, can afford to expound on the race issue unabashedly. A great gap continues to exist between the scientific view of race and the view posited by the popular media. The scientifically disproven views of Marxists such as Gould, Kamin, and Lowitin are still presented to the public as the mainstream scientific opinion in consumer-oriented magazines such as Discover and the Smithsonian. On a brighter note, however, behavioral geneticists have made great strides in educating the public and understanding the genetic basis of male and female behavior. Biologically born behavioral differences in male and female brains have found popular expression in new terms such as right-brained and left-brained. In the political realm, the acknowledgement of racial truth remains far scarcer than in science. Every politician quickly learns never to challenge the egalitarian view. To do so would invite political banishment. America's traditional, racially structured social systems were rapidly dismantled and then restructured on the false premise of racial equality. Carlton Putnam, Dr. William Shockley, Dr. Arthur Jensen, and many others showed how the new social experiments were failing and were destined to do severe damage to American society. But the media and government establishment relentlessly promoted and expanded the new racial policies. Areas having large black populations, such as those in the South and in the large cities of the North and West, quickly degenerated. Social disaster struck the black community first. As white controls and guidance were relaxed, black crime rose to intolerable levels, schools deteriorated, illicit drug abuse and addiction spread out of control, illegitimacy soared, and the black family disintegrated. Welfare rolls exploded, venereal disease reached epidemic proportions. All these social calamities were the opposite of what the egalitarians had promised would occur with the granting of political and social equality. The veneer of European-style culture and morality imposed on the black community for centuries crumbled in the wake of social emancipation. Whites, of course, suffered from the changes as well. The quality of public education rapidly declined under integration. Millions of whites were driven from public schools and ultimately from the glittering cities they had built, fueling the rise of suburbia. Millions more fell victim to increased black crime. Whites endured dramatically higher taxes and paid the higher cost necessary to sustain an increasingly dependent and dysfunctional black community. And the political power structure changed as the minority voting blocs held the balance of power. The federal government also intensified its efforts to destroy underpinnings of the European American. forced busing, expanded racial integration, discrimination against better qualified European Americans, euphemistically labeled affirmative action, became institutionalized in the public and private sector. Government-funded minority housing programs systematically destroyed white communities all across America. Beginning in 1965, federal immigration policies began to discriminate against European immigrants while facilitating increased non-white immigration. At the same time, huge numbers of non-white illegal immigrants were allowed to overrun America's borders. Unchecked immigration, along with high minority birth rates, transformed much American geography into scenes and sociology reminiscent of the Third World. European Americans moved ever closer to minority status in our own country. As both black and white society suffered under these policies, no one questioned the shibboleth of racial equality. In spite of the sacrifice of their schools, neighborhoods, cities, tax money, and even many of their lives on the altar of racial equality, white people were not appreciated for their efforts, but blamed for the chronic black failure. European Americans were told that these worsening problems could be solved only by even higher expenditures for social welfare programs and education. And the egalitarians told us that the cure for what ailed America was really more integration, more multiculturalism, and, quote, diversity. To the media, government establishment, whatever sacrifices whites made were never enough. By the end of the 20th century, most family core values had dissolved among blacks in direct correlation to their achieving greater social and political rights. As of this writing, more than 70% of black children are born illegitimate, and at any given moment, well over a third of all young black males in America are in jail, on probation, or parole. Perhaps the most devastating effect of the civil rights movement was the epidemic of crime that denied millions their most basic civil right of all, the right not to be physically violated by intimidation, rape, robbery, and murder. The next section is black crime. Quote, this is from black poet Leroy Jones, Mamou Amiri Baraka, similar to Barack Obama. Quote, you can't steal nothing from a white man. He's already stole it. He owes you everything you want, even his life. All the stores will open up to you if you say the magic words. The magic words are up against the wall, mother. You know what? This is a stick up. Or smash the window at night. These are the magic actions. Smash the windows daytime, anytime, together. Let's smash the window, drag the shit from in there. No money down, no time to pay. Just take what you want. Unquote. Perhaps the most pernicious effect of the new race-blind policies was a crime rate never before seen in Western civilization. Until the time I became racially aware in my mid-teens, I had never thought much about black crime. Living in an all-white neighborhood and attending all-white schools and churches, I had no fear of crime because I had no experience of it. If I returned home late at night on the dimly lit streets of my neighborhood, the only fear I had was that my father's punishment for being late. Crime concerns never crossed my mind. Since the enforced joys of integration and diversity, of course, every child now becomes conscious of crime almost before he learns his ABCs. Other than our housekeeper, Pinky, the most contact I had with blacks was working occasionally at Gary's Garage, located on Clio Street, a black section of New Orleans on the periphery of the business district. Now, that was before the civil rights movement's social changes had much impact on the mores or lifestyles of either blacks or whites. Of course, I knew that the black areas of New Orleans were more dangerous. Sometimes when I was finishing up on a job, I stayed until after dark. The first times in my life that I had real fear of crime occurred when I walked from the shop down the trash-laden block and a half of the garage to St. Charles Avenue and my streetcar stopped. During the short walks, I sometimes saw a menacing stare or heard an ill-bred comment or two coming from the dark faces in the shadows. The clanging of the streetcar bell often accompanied my own sigh of relief as the steel tracks below carried me away from the dark street. One of the reasons I stopped going down to the shop was that the Times-Picayune and the television news had increasingly frequent stories of crime very near the area I visited. After the well-publicized robbery and murder of a delivery man only one street down from the repair shop, my father wouldn't let me go there anymore, at least not by myself. On some Saturdays, I would ride down with him when he had some repair work to be done. Books, magazine articles, and television shows seldom discussed the black crime rate, instead just referred to the rising crime rate. When higher incidences of crime among blacks were reported by the media, they never explicitly revealed its incredibly disproportionate levels as compared to those of whites. Most white Americans even today aren't fully cognizant of them. The media offered poverty and racism as the simple explanations for black crime. In effect, they were saying that it was white people who were ultimately responsible for it, that the repression of blacks by the white social system caused the poverty that in turn caused the crime. At that time, I accepted the explanation because it sounded logical, and after all, I had seen no counter evidence in the mainstream media. 3 years after reading Race and Reason, by my 16th birthday, I'd learned a great deal about racial differences. I had filled a fair-sized mahogany bookcase in my room with the books and articles that I had read and researched. I could have probably filled another one with the material I had read or borrowed from the public school library and from the Citizens Council shelves. I knew of the racial difference in IQ and how IQ strongly is correlated with higher rates of criminality. The lower the IQ, the higher the crime. I also knew that differences in the brains of blacks and whites, and even the differences in hormones, such as higher levels of testosterone in black males, had an influence on crime. I was also aware of the studies showing different behavioral patterns of blacks and whites that could not be explained away by environment. And I had a grasp of the rudimentary evolutionary differences that had been simultaneously created over the tens of thousands of years in the ice ages of Europe and in the tropics of sub-Saharan Africa. Those evolutionary characteristics seemed consistent with the historical record of civilization. I liked science and history much more than politics, and that's what I concentrated on, delving into my books and articles on race every day. Now that I live much further from the forests and swamps in New Orleans, I spent much more time engrossed in reading. I also developed a keener interest in the effects of racial dynamics on current events. Most of the books I found in the library sported the liberal interpretations, but the Citizens Council had one of the best libraries in the South on race and related conservative issues. A number of the authors argued that the dramatic increase of crime, coinciding with the change in the black and white social structure, warned of a dangerous future for the nation. America was declining much like the civilizations I had read about. The coming racial disaster seemed as clear to me as the increasing frequency of police sirens that interrupted the humid, once quiet summer nights of New Orleans. At the same time that blacks made great economic gains through the civil rights movement, black crime increased dramatically. By the mid-1960s, blacks making up 11% of the population were committing almost half of the most violent crimes. The media exclaimed that poverty and justified black resentment for white racism had caused the crime explosion But none of the pundits and social interpreters could explain away the underlying inconsistencies. If poverty and its effects were the primary culprits of crime, why was it that whites, who were close to 90% of the population and at least two-thirds of the people under the poverty level of income, were committing only half the crime? I pointed out to one of my teachers that it wasn't only the poor who committed crimes. Sometimes middle-class people and even upper-income people violated the law. Shouldn't 9/10 of the population and 2/3 of the poor be committing the vast majority of the crime if it was social factors? I asked. The next line of argument, fashioned to explain all black difficulties and chastise racially impious thoughts, was the allegation of white racist injustice. But, I thought, haven't there been millions of whites who have been cheated or mistreated by other people and who have suffered broken families, alcoholism, child abuse, and other indignities, but who don't, as teenagers, run out into the night and rape elderly women? At the time, in my area, a number of elderly women living alone were brutally raped and abused by black intruders. This is something that still goes on today in modern America, in 21st century America. If oppression and racism causes crime, I question why the black crime rate was far less under Jim Crow than it is today. When I brought up these issues to my teachers, they had inadequate answers. Moreover, if one accepts that poverty causes crime, the question must be asked, what causes poverty? Good question. Murray and Herrnstein and the bell curve and many other researchers have shown that low IQ correlates strongly with poverty and criminality. Inability to delay gratification would also contribute to joblessness and poverty. Black lower IQ and less ability to delay gratification have already been thoroughly covered in this volume. Yet, even if one accepts the poverty and repression argument, it certainly could not explain the incredible extent of the differences. In 1904, when blacks were jailed much less than they are today, the mean per capita wealth of blacks was only 2.5% of the whites. Black income is now about 20% that of whites, but the crime rate has not dropped. Moreover, between 1930 and 1990, the proportion of blacks living in poverty fell from more than 90% to about 30%. During the same period, black prisoners increased from 25% of the total prison population to today's more than 50%. The latest analysis shows that whites' hourly wages are on average only about a third, 133%, higher than that of blacks, yet black crime rates were many times higher than just a third higher. And by the way, I must point out that the latest studies, the National Longitudinal Study of Youth by the federal government, shows that blacks and whites of equal higher education and equal intelligence find a disproportionate higher black salary range and net worth than whites have. It's pretty amazing. In fact, black women of the top, the second tier of top percentile, actually earn about twice per year more than white women of the same intelligence. If there's any discrimination going on, it's going on against white people, and yet black crime has continued to soar. Since my first inquiries in the 60s, the black crime rate has continued to increase. Some of the most recent crime figures show that blacks, constituting about 12% of the population, account for 62% of the arrests for robbery, 57% of the murders, and 50% of all the crimes for assault and rape. The per capita crime rates are much higher for blacks than for whites, yet most whites and blacks have no inkling of the vast extent of the difference. I must say, though, that black percentages will probably go down a little bit because of the vast increase of minorities from Mexico and other third world countries, some of them even black, some of them not, but they're classed basically as Hispanics rather than blacks or whites, and this may lower the black overall percentage of crime in relation to the crime picture. Even though I understood the marked evolutionary differences between white and black in race, the black crime rate was far beyond what I'd expected. I had guessed that blacks were committing roughly 25% to 50% more crime per capita than whites, or possibly even twice the amount of crime as whites. This is what I thought as a young man. 100% higher crime rate by blacks seemed exceedingly high, but my estimates turned out to be dramatically low. FBI uniform crime reports in the 1990s have shown that blacks commit about 1,200% or 12 times the per capita robbery rate of whites, and about 900% or 9 times the murder rate per capita. And despite these outrageous numbers, the government method of record keeping suppresses the true extent of the differences in the black-white crime rate. In comparing the per capita rate of crime between whites and blacks, the white group includes Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, other Hispanic elements who are predominantly not of European heritage. In California, where some crime tallies often separate whites, blacks, and Hispanics, the assault rates for black males aged 15 to 24 are 598 per 100,000, whereas the white non-Hispanic rate is only 27 per 100,000. That's a 2,200%, 22 times higher black assault rate. Now, the liberal media offers all sorts of explanations for the higher crime rates in the United States as compared to Europe. One of the trendiest arguments is that easy availability of guns causes the high murder rate. This is an important one for Europeans because they don't understand this question very much. They show how the homicide rate in America is 9.3 per 100,000 population as compared to 4.5 in France, 4.7 in Germany, 4.8 in Britain, 2.3 in Austria, and similar low rates in the other countries. And by the way, you can get all this data and this elements of information from my hard text, my printed text of My Awakening. I urge you to take a look at it, read it, study it, check out the footnotes. Thus, America has a murder rate that's double that of Europe. Gun control advocates claim that Europe's strict gun control laws are responsible for the lower rates. Well, blacks commit 55% of the murders in the United States, whereas whites commit 43%. At 12.1% of the population, the murder rate for blacks is 44.9 per 100,000. For whites, which includes Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, and other Hispanics of questionable white origin, the rate is 4.78 per 100,000. When one considers the disproportionate crime rate among Hispanics and the fact that between 1/4 and 1/3 of our federal prisoners are not American citizens, one realizes that the crime rate for European Americans in this country is in line with or even less than that of the European nations, and yet, of course, we have all those guns. Even with the Hispanics included, the white American murder rate is slightly lower than that of Britain. A nation, the British nation, has some of the strictest gun control laws in the world. With the Hispanics subtracted from the white murder rate, even with our millions of guns, white Americans have a lower murder rate than the European average. It is comparable to Switzerland, an all-white nation where practically every adult male citizen must by law keep a gun at home as part of the National Defense Forces, and their homicide rate is only 3.2 per 100,000. Within the United States, let us compare the tougher gun control areas such as New York to a high per capita gun-owning state such as Utah. In Utah, with one of the more liberal gun laws and one of the whitest populations in America, the murder rate is below 1 per 100,000 people. It may be the height of political incorrectness to state it, but the facts tell us it is not large numbers of guns that cause increased crime and obviously many thousands of innocent people dying. It is large numbers of certain racial minorities. High black crime rates are not limited to the United States. They're confirmed on a worldwide basis. Professor J. Philip Rushton, professor of psychology at the University of Western Ontario, Canada, has compiled the crime data from Interpol, an international police organization made up of 100 member nations. In studying the data for 23 predominantly African countries and 41 mostly Caucasian nations, the assorted crime figures composites average 243 crimes per 100,000 for the black nations and 74 for the mostly white nations. Even these dramatic figures greatly inflate the white crime rate because black crime affects the overall crime rate in nations such as the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and France, which are overwhelmingly Caucasian nations. After almost 40 years of civil rights, economic and educational opportunity, political freedom, and endless government programs, black crime rates continue to increase to the point that the Washington Post reported that in our nation's capital, 50% of all young 18 to 35 black males, 50% now, are currently felons in the criminal justice system. They are in jail, on probation or parole, currently charged with a felony, or there's an arrest warrant out for them. Here's a quote from the Washington Post. D.C. has a population of 48,856 black men in this age range, and 24,377, or nearly 50%, are incarcerated on parole or probation, awaiting trial, or being sought on an arrest warrant on any given day, according to a study that covered the first quarter of 1997. Washington Post, August 26, 1997. And take a look again at my hard copy of My Awakening. Now, these numbers do not include those who have completed their terms of incarceration or parole. It does not include those who have committed crimes but are unidentified. When one considers that the perpetrators of most crimes are never caught, it is clear that a vast majority of young black males in Washington, D.C. are, in fact, criminals and have engaged in criminal behavior. Stating such a fact might sound very harsh, but it's the plain truth. In fact, in an article by Adam Walensky in the July 1995 issue of Atlantic Monthly, the writer pointed out that one Washington, D.C. study estimated that upwards of 75% of black males would be arrested by age 35, and 85% of black males would be arrested for a felony in their lifetime. Nationally, about one-third of all black males are currently enmeshed in the criminal justice system, and well over 50% will be arrested for a felony by the time they are 35 years old. As amazing as the extreme differences in the crime rates between whites and blacks are, the political and media establishment have effectively kept the facts from the public. Not only have they misrepresented the causes of crime as guns and poverty and racism, they have intentionally deceived the American people about the terrifying realities of the black crime epidemic. Many people have a vague idea about the higher black crime rates because they have seen frequent black faces of the apprehended or those sought by the police and television news reporting, which relies on photos or films. Most of television programming, though, is made up of dramatic series and movies, and in those often emotionally powerful programs, the percentage of black criminals portrayed is vastly underrepresented. Television and films also portray the criminal justice system as racist and unfair to blacks. And hate crimes are almost always depicted as being committed by white perpetrators who prey on black or other minority victims. In 1983, Robert and Linda Richter published a study of primetime television that showed that only about 10% of those portrayed in television dramas as criminals were black. Even more important, no viewer can help but notice that when there is a cross-race victim shown on television series, it is almost always a black victimized by depraved white racists. It has become a TV and movie given that when a crime has racial motivation, the perpetrators are evil white people. I found out that there are many myths about black crime. A prevalent myth is that most black crime is committed against other blacks, therefore it has little effect on the white community. And that belief is shattered by fairly recent crime data from 1987 showing that whereas only 3% of white crime is committed against blacks, well over 50% of black crime is committed against whites. In 1987, 50.2% of assaults by blacks had white victims. From the year 79 to 86, 2,416,696 of the 4 million, over 4 million assaults committed annually by blacks had white victims, a cross-racial rate of 59%. Proportionally, this means that blacks are at least 2,500%, 25 times more likely to victimize whites than whites are to victimize blacks. For those who say whites should not be concerned about black crime, those figures mean that almost 2.5 million white victims of black assault occurred in just 7 years. And that doesn't even count the estimated millions of assaults that have become so common that they often go unreported. In murder rates, similar ratios apply. According to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports from 1993, blacks are 2,200%, 22 times more likely to kill whites than whites are to kill blacks. In armed robbery, 7,031 blacks were victimized by whites, whereas 167,924 whites had black assailants. As shocking as these figures are, I must again note that the government record-keeping makes the higher black percentages of cross-race crime seem far less than they actually are, because many crimes that are classified as white against blacks are not perpetrated by whites at all, but come from the Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, and other Hispanic minorities, and many of them are actually of African descent. And they're statistically lumped in with white people. For instance, the shooting of a black by mestizo Mexicans in a drug deal gone black is classified as a white-on-black crime. The rape of a black woman by a black Spanish-speaking Puerto Rican will be classified as a white-on-black rape. Or the same Puerto Rican rape of a white woman would be classified as a white-on-white rape. Even more tragic is the epidemic rate of black rapes against white women. The American Enterprise Institute analyzed rape records of the FBI from 1991 and found that while there were only 100 rapes of black women by white men that year in America, again, statistically questionable because of the Hispanic mix, there were 20,000 white women raped by blacks. That's 200 white women raped by blacks for every one black female raped by whites. I will give you some new statistics that are not on my hard copy in a few minutes that are extremely shocking, even far more shocking. As nefarious as the black and white ratio of rape is, much of the accumulated evidence shows that it's far worse than the FBI's staggering numbers. A 1974 study of rapes conducted in Denver, a city of relatively low black population, showed that black rape of white women constituted 40% of all rapes, and not one case of white-on-black rape could be documented. Dr. William Wilbanks, a Florida International University criminologist, after sifting through large amounts of data on rape, found that in 1988, there were only 10 cases in America of whites raping black women. Now, I'm going to mention some new studies which have been done that are even more shocking. There's been a national survey done by the United States Department of Justice to determine the victims of crime. And part of the reason is to make sure that blacks aren't being criminalized and that the different groups are doing well. But they list often predators and victims. And in the last 4 years, according to this incredibly large survey and study, which is compiled by hospital reports, criminal reports, and the rest. The United States government says that in the last 4 years, in the United States of America, there have been over 100,000 white women raped or sexually assaulted by black males. Now, that's pretty shocking in its own self. But I want you to consider the next fact that this study showed. Because this study does differentiate between Hispanics and whites and blacks, it shows that in the last 4 years, the number of white sexual assaults or rapes against black women is statistically zero, meaning less than 10 a year. Think of that for a moment. 100,000 white women sexually assaulted by black males, a terrible crime of rape or assault, and statistically zero black women assaulted, sexually assaulted or raped by white males. Imagine if those figures were reversed and 100,000 black women were being raped by white males and no white women were being raped. There'd be marches in the street and there'd be human rights allegations and attacks, and America would be being attacked all over the world. You see, it appears that white women's sense of privacy and health and wholeness and well-being is not equal anymore to minorities. And this is a perfect example of the terrible human rights violations that are accompanying these racial differences under the pretense of equality. We have massive increases of human rights crime. We've heard a lot about civil rights. I'll talk about this in a few minutes, but we've heard a lot about civil rights and the terrible crimes of segregation of whites and blacks. You know, but what is the difference? What is really the fundamental moral difference between a discrimination where blacks simply go to their own schools and an innocent person being injured or crippled or raped or robbed, and that happened in their life? To me, that's far worse. And the truth is that whites are victims of this black crime and criminal attacks in incredible numbers, by the tens of millions in America. I'll give you some more statistics on that in a few minutes. But we're supposed to be silent about that, think it's okay, and it really shows the effect, the racial effect, the demographic effect of immigration. I showed you, and birth rates and all the rest of it. I showed you earlier, in earlier chapters, about the effects of race on culture and civilization. We're seeing it in things like the crime that exists, not only in America, but in Canada and Europe as well. Even if one takes the lowest possible figures for black rape, could the reader imagine the outcry if white men in America raped 10 black women for every one white woman raped by blacks? White rape of black women in those numbers would cause a national scandal, congressional investigations, civil rights marches, and prayer vigils and massive media outrage, not only here in America but around the world. Yet the massive numbers of black male rapes against white women are met with silence by the media, like it didn't even exist. Another media-generated public perception is that there's not enough emphasis on white-collar crime, which is less covered because they suggest it's mostly white. But in reality, even in so-called white-collar crime, such as embezzlement, forgery, counterfeiting, and receiving stolen property, blacks are about 300%, three times, more likely to be arrested than whites. Perhaps the most commonly accepted racial myth about crime, promoted in the media and in many universities, is that America has a racist criminal justice system. Black criminals, they say, are treated far more harshly than whites. They point out that those who kill whites are more likely to be executed than those who kill blacks. Those who repeatedly quote this lone fact leave out far more important statistics. And here they are, and the documentation is in my book. Even though blacks commit far more murders than whites, whites have been the majority of those executed since the reinstatement of the death penalty. White murderers are about 50% more likely to be sentenced to death than are black murderers. Whites who kill whites are more likely to face the death penalty than blacks who kill whites. And whites who murder blacks have a greater likelihood of a death row stay and execution than blacks who kill whites. A typical example of the biased reporting on this subject is found in a major feature article in the Atlanta Constitution, the Atlanta Journal, on April 30, 1989. The article, with the provocative headline, "Blacks Sent to Jail More Than Whites for the Same Crime," extended over many pages and even included maps showing blacks were sent to jail in some Georgia counties as much as twice as often as whites for the same crimes. 46 inches into the copy, the reader learns that the study ignored prior convictions. Ignoring prior convictions obviously made the study completely worthless, because criminals with prior convictions will obviously receive longer sentences than those with clean records, and blacks are far more likely to be repeat offenders, which naturally leads to longer sentencing. It is similar to the stories proving how blacks face discrimination in obtaining home mortgages by showing lower approval percentages for blacks than for whites. Many of those stories conveniently ignore the fact that black incomes and credit reports are generally inferior to that of white applicants. As a side note here in my audio book, you know, well, that's been remedied, right? We had this massive, over the last 5 or 6 years, this massive allowance of these subprime loans to people without jobs and with criminal records, the minorities, where President Bush promised millions of minorities who could not qualify for loans the right to live in the same kind of a house as a white person. And now we've had the largest or the worst economic debacle and collapse in America probably since the 1930s. In fact, evidence suggests that blacks are much more inclined than whites to acquit clearly guilty black defendants in urban felony trials. Black jury pools convict at rates far below the national average. So if anything, the criminal justice system is discriminating in favor of black criminals, not against them and in favor of whites. By a twisted logic, claims of a racist system are used to justify even the most brutal of black crimes, such as O.J. Simpson's acquittal in the grisly murder of his white wife and her acquaintance. In the most publicized murder trial of the 20th century, the case turned not on the defendant's guilt or innocence, but on whether one of the police detectives in the case had racist attitudes. In many major cities, prosecutors find it increasingly difficult to convict black criminals before black juries. An endless parade of civil cases in the major cities finds black juries inclined to render outlandish judgments for black plaintiffs against white defendants. When blacks and whites are on the opposite sides of the bar in civil or criminal matters, or when white and black interests seem to conflict in cases, whites will seldom find justice before the mostly black juries. Most successful insurance plaintiff attorneys strike potential white jurors and seek to impanel black juries because they are known for their liberal, often outrageous, awards. A number of insurance executives have told me that the phenomenon is one of the major reasons for higher insurance rates. Blacks are far more prone to, as they say, put it to the man. The traditional Anglo-Saxon legal system, with its presumption of innocence, is possible only through the natural integrity of its citizens. A legal system that is based on the natural tendency of people to be law-abiding can be much more free than one trying to maintain order in a society in which the urges toward violence and sexual aggression are more powerful than those traits favoring control and restraint. When half of the young black men in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, are criminals, society has the unacceptable choice of draconian laws or barbarism in the streets. The traditional system simply cannot work. Our justice system functioned well in the past only because most people would not commit a robbery, a rape, or a murder regardless of whether there was a law against it. Now that our streets teem with those whose only restraint is the law, civilization becomes replaced by the law of the jungle. When the social and legal system in America became equalized for unequal people, all hell broke loose, creating a level of barbarism in our country that has never been seen in the history of European civilization, except perhaps in wartime. When I first looked over the crime figures, I began to understand just how brainwashed I had been about egalitarianism. After the 1963 bombing of a Birmingham church, when I thought of the race question, all I saw in my mind were the school photos of the four little black girls who had been killed. It was a heinous crime, to be sure, an act of political terrorism protesting the overthrow of Southern culture. No civilized society can tolerate such lawlessness. The misguided perpetrators of the crime did more to advance the civil rights movement, so-called civil rights movement, than 1,000 marches. But now I had to ask myself, was that act any more heinous than the rape and murder of thousands of white women by black criminals, 100,000 in the last 4 years, satisfying their lust for sex and vengeance and blood? Since the fateful bombing in 63, there have been thousands of white girls who have suffered rape or murder at the hands of hate-filled blacks. And for each one of those black girls in Birmingham, there have been thousands of white women who have so suffered, and thousands who have been murdered. They were white victims who would have probably never have experienced such a fate except for the so-called civil rights movement, which I'll argue in a few moments, was not about civil rights at all, but it was a movement that took away the most basic civil rights or human rights of our people. Black Panther, the very famous Black Panther leader, Eldridge Cleaver, wrote a book called Soul on Ice, which is still available in the bookstores of America. It lauds the rape and abasement of white women. Cleaver wrote the following, and I quote, "And when I considered myself smooth enough, I crossed the tracks and sought out white prey. I did this consciously, deliberately, willfully, methodically. Though looking back, I see I was in a frantic, wild, and completely abandoned frame of mind. Rape was an insurrectionary act. It delighted me that I was defying and trampling upon the white man's law, upon a system of values, and that I was defiling his women." Unquote. Cleaver also quotes a poem by the famous Leroy Jones, who I quoted earlier, "Come up, black data, nihilismus, rape the white girls, rape their fathers, cut the mothers' throats." Unquote. Now, Cleaver's book was actually praised by many literary critics for his passionate call for, quote, justice for black people. The New York Times Book Review called it brilliant and revealing. Eldridge Cleaver died in 1997. To his credit, he renounced his wicked ways and was a convert to Christianity. However, the critics who praised it have not repented. The next section is the false arguments of egalitarians. Very important, because I think this will give you some ammunition to some of the arguments that egalitarians will give you and our people when we talk about these incredible facts of racial differences and the incredible harm that has befallen both our people and their people because of these policies based on egalitarian untruths. How can so little be said in the national media of the black plague of crime that has transformed so many of our streets into places of fear and so many homes into reverse jails, barred to keep out the criminal? Instead of the truth about racial differences in crime, we constantly hear things like, quote, white people do bad things too, unquote. Or, this is a standard, and I've heard it all my life, well, there's good and bad among all races. These two statements are true, but they're far from the whole truth. It's similar to saying that there are good people who can be found in prison and bad people found outside the prison. Should we therefore not recognize the group differences between the criminally convicted and the law-abiding? Not recognizing group differences and acting accordingly is a prescription for disaster. In New Orleans, black predators have murdered a number of Northern as well as European tourists who have ventured into the minority neighborhoods in the periphery of our famous French Quarter. Parking their cars in those areas where the parking is free is something that few white residents would do because they have a local awareness of the black crime problem. Out-of-towners who are not as aware of the racial realities of New Orleans, or for that matter of America, have suffered robbery, rape, and murder. For fear of being branded racist, printed tourist guides that readily offer warnings of high prices or poor cuisine will not inform tourists of the serious threat to their lives in the black sections near the French Quarter. The notion that there is good and bad in all races and that white people do bad things too does not help the whites, who find torture and death at the hands of black thugs. If they had recognized that blacks are generally far more dangerous than whites on average, many white victims could have avoided those areas and not become victims. Patrick Sheehan, one of the most famous journalists, by the way, in Australia, writing for the Sydney Australia Morning Herald in 1995, wrote what American newspapers would not dare to write. He analyzed the FBI uniform crime reports for the 30 years since the so-called civil rights movement began and found 170 million crimes against white America. Quote, "The longest war America has ever fought is the Dirty War, and it's not over. It has lasted 30 years so far and claimed more than 25 million victims. It has cost almost as many lives as the Vietnam War. It determined the result of last year's congressional election. Yet the American news media do not want to talk about the Dirty War, which remains between the lines and unreported. When all the crime figures are calculated, it appears that black Americans have committed at least 170 million crimes against white Americans in the past 30 years. It is the great defining disaster of American life and American ideals since World War II. All these are facts. Yet by simply writing the story, by assembling the facts in this way, I would be deemed a racist by the American news media. It prefers to maintain a paternalistic double standard in its coverage of black America, a lower standard." Unquote. Black crime had ballooned in the middle 1960s, and I could see that it would only get worse through the last third of the 20th century as the white control of the direction of American society diminished even more. I thought about the social system of segregation that had black and white water fountains and separate restrooms and segregated schools and housing, and the once strict enforcement of laws on blacks. I wondered how the indignity of racial segregation compared to the ultimate indignities of and just horror of thousands of violent rapes, robberies, and murders. Millions of European Americans have paid a high price for the so-called civil rights revolution, far too high a price. Ironically, millions of black crime victims have paid the price for it as well. For as the structure of law of white law and order broke down, they have suffered from the increased crime committed by their own brethren. I also ask myself, what is a civil right? How terrible is drinking from a segregated water fountain compared to being raped, robbed, or murdered? How bad is it for members of each race to freely go to schools of their own choice, tailored to their own needs, rather than endure the conflict, violence, and educational mediocrity of the integrated school? How does the right to force one race onto another contrast to the right to live and the right to live without fear of violence? The federal government has caused millions of white people to become crime victims in pursuit of black civil rights, which was supposed to bring us peace, love, and brotherhood. The black crime rate has always been much higher against whites than the white crime rate against blacks, and juveniles commit large percentages of violence. The segregated schools and neighborhoods of the past certainly did not cause black students to be victimized by white criminals. In fact, there were no whites in their neighborhoods or schools at all. But integration has subjected millions of white children to predatory black criminality, intimidation, and violence. Every American has heard a chronic recital of the mistreatment of blacks over the years, the indignities of slavery, which ended more than 140 years ago, are repeatedly brought up, and whining black leaders remind their own people and us of its injustices almost daily. Every American has also seen graphic photographs of African American victims of lynch mobs from earlier times in American history. Such chronic recital of white suppression teaches blacks to hate white people, and the white people are made to feel an oppressive collective guilt. But how does the white lynching of blacks in American history compare to the murderous black crime wave today? Egalitarians went through mountains of historical records to put a precise number on the lynchings in the years between 1882 and 1962. The Negro Almanac proclaimed that a total of 34,000 blacks and 1,294 whites were lynched during that period. From 1947 to 1961, lynchings averaged less than one a year. As terrible as lynching was, it was almost always done in response to serious criminal behavior such as rape or murder. In contrast, the black crime wave today is levied upon the innocent almost entirely, those who were never accused of any crime. Whereas lynchings almost always occurred against men, the new victims of brutality are often those least able to defend themselves: women, the very young, and the elderly. The days of lynching are long over, but black crimes against white people continue to exist. Jesse Jackson once made the powerful point that more blacks murder and abuse each other in one year than all blacks murdered in a physically abused and murdered by whites in the last 100 years. And the same thing is true for black crimes against whites. More whites are murdered and raped in one year by blacks than all the blacks lynched by whites in the last 100 years. Far more. But there's no outcry. There's no protest, no wringing of hands, only deafening silence. Nobody even protests the explicitly racist black campaigns to end, quote, black-on-black crime, as if the massive brutality of black-on-white crime doesn't even matter. With the new statistics I have about racial sexual assault against white women, 100,000 white women victims in 4 years, as compared to no black women victims of white sexual assault, you look at that compared to the history of lynching, it's just absolutely amazing. In 1 year, just a couple years ago, 10 times the number of white women were raped or sexually assaulted in that 1 year, as compared 10 times more white women than the lynchings that occurred in the last 100 years. But this isn't an issue. And again, the media programs us. Whites are taught a collective guilt for slavery, even though less than 10% of Americans were ever slaveholders. Yet there is no collective guilt for the fact that upwards of 50% of black males will likely be convicted of a felony, and many of them, as I've shown, committing felonies against white people. Many times as a young man, I would see black victims of discrimination or physical abuse on dramatic television programs, and my heart went out to them. As I grew older and learned the reality of black crime, I began to think for myself, and I learned that individual injustices by fanatics can always be found to condemn any ideology. Focusing on the poignant killing of 4 little black girls, the media used the tragic event as a psychological wedge for the civil rights movement and the implementation of their social programs. If the media had been on the opposing side of the issue, they could easily have exploited the thousands of white victims of black crime and brought many handkerchiefs to the eyes of those who would become resolved to work against the policies of integration and the damage that it did to our people. Each one of those stories of the rape or torture or murder of innocent white victims told with empathy and passion could bring tears to the eyes of the hardest soul. But telling those tragedies is counter to the media's ideological goals, so instead they focused their attention on the extremely rare white-on-black crime. Hardworking Americans have lost billions of dollars of their hard-earned tax money for the social programs launched by the civil rights movement, programs that have done nothing but spawn crime and hurt the black family. Paying that huge tax sum has hurt the white family. Schools have been lost, fine old homes and areas of cities have been abandoned, and cities criminalized and governments corrupted. Another scandal that one often never hears about is that of black perpetrated homosexual rape against whites in jails and prisons. It has become so commonplace in American jails that in some places, white prisoners have filed suit trying to get the authorities to act to prevent rapes and sexual attacks. Again, this is documented in my hard copy, My Awakening, and I suggest all of you who have not read it, or if you've not read the latest edition, order the new edition with a complete index and wonderful resources on this data. American comedians frequently allude to the fate met by thousands of white prisoners in the overwhelmingly black prisons of America. Sodomitical rape certainly fulfills the constitutional definition of cruel and unusual punishment. And today, with AIDS common among black drug addicts and criminals, it can also result in an agonizing death to the victims. Much like the disproportionate rate of rape against white women, this subject is almost never mentioned by serious news media. Charles Silberman, in his book Criminal Violence, Criminal Justice, writes about the epidemic of black-on-white homosexual rape. Quote, "A young offender, particularly a white offender, is likely to be subjected to gang rape his first night in jail. In a number of large cities, jail officials automatically place young whites in protective custody for their own safety. Sometimes the move comes too late. Young offenders often raped in the van transporting them to jail. One man's defeat is another man's triumph. The ultimate triumph is to destroy another man's manhood, to break his will, defile his body, and make him feel totally and often permanently degraded. And when the wolf, rapist, is black and the punk, victim, is white, the most frequent arrangement, by far, the wolf's demonstration of power, is infinitely sweeter." Unquote. As I discovered the horrible truth about the massive homosexual rape of white prisoners by blacks, I became incensed. The media defense of forced integration of the races as a moral imperative has resulted in the rapes of tens of thousands of white men in America's prisons. However, this terrible injustice finds almost no voice from the preachers and pundits. According to their twisted sense of morality, it's better that young men be raped by the thousands than to reveal the animalistic behavior commonly found in black criminals. One more example, this is my audio version, one more example of the twisted morality we have. To save the feelings of blacks than to talk about the black criminals that are abusing our people, that's more important than the victims who suffer horrible crimes of rape and violence. As a young man, my heart had been manipulated by the media, but as I grew older, I began to see a more complete picture. I began to see the massive wrong being done against those of our own heritage, a great tragedy that will continue to multiply until we have the courage to face it and the power to end it. I reasoned that if the media tried to make me and all whites feel angry and upset about white mistreatment of blacks, was I not justified in being upset about the white victims of black criminality? As I began to gain a deeper understanding of race differences in criminal behavior, I fully understood the injustice of integration of public education. Because blacks are significantly less intelligent than whites, like all studies show, at least 10 times more likely to commit assaults than our whites, and juveniles are per capita the most violent segment of the population, white children face intolerable conditions when they are in mostly black public schools. The media frequently allege widespread white hatred of Negroes for no good reason. Yet, by biased portrayal of white abuse and racism, the media teaches blacks to hate white people. How strange it is that when liberals put white children in schools with low IQ, violent-prone, white-hating black juveniles, they call it an act that fosters love and brotherhood. The next section of this Race and Society chapter, and it's a very large chapter, so I'm going to divide this in two parts for the audio book. It's called Integration of Education, and I have a lot more to say about this subject, and I think this is one of the most interesting chapters in the book, and it really brings together all the material you've learned and you've read so far. I look forward to continuing the next section of our chapter, Race and Society, with the Integration of Education.